doing so, I want, if I can, to treat it quite separately from the issue of war between nations, although it is probably all that again. Very recently, a statement was issued by a group of British friends, and it was the result of giving you all the details. What motivated this was the decision of the World Council of Churches to make grants to liberation movements in Africa, even though this would have involved, this would have supported the use of violence. This led to this until the recent increase in crimes of violence against the person, warfare between sovereign states was beginning to stand out in splendid isolation. The fact that the institution of war, though outlawed, is still with us is no ground for approving the return to premeditated violence more generally. Such violence is a step backwards and behind warfare between nations, towards anarchy, barbarism, and the breakdown of society altogether. Now, I expect there are some, though by no means all, who might consider that throughout the 19th and into the 20th century, generally in the Western world, there has been some steady fall in the rate of violence. This, however, is arguable, depends on the point of view you take. But then we have the Nazis. In these post-World War II years, we seem to have been witnessing a reversal of this trend. Perhaps it would be better to say that the violence has always been endemic, but the main means of communication, the press, the television, and so on, bring it more dramatically and immediately to our opinion. Now, recent obvious examples are the hijacking of aircraft, because even though they may not lead to loss of life, they are certainly violence. The taking and killing of hospitals, the massacres of law, is that better? Yeah. I apologize. These killings of the lot and the massacres in Khartoum, they are merely some of the examples, the recent ones that come to mind. For that matter, I suppose so do the daily muggings and murders and rapings that occur in New York and other cities of the world. But there are other instances, sometimes on a more massive scale, which though little publicized are nonetheless horrifying. Last year, tribal antagonisms between the Hutus and Tutsis in Burundi took a toll of lives estimated at anything between 50 and 100,000 people. And this was scarcely known, scarcely mentioned in the press. All these are examples of a resort to violence either to achieve, however misguidedly, some purpose, or for its own sake. Though I suppose, in philosophical terms, an argument can be advanced that even violence for its own sake has some purpose for the perpetrator of it. But whatever the reason for violence, its presence must be of concern to friends, and its increase, if it is increasing, surely even more so. Against this background, several of us at the Quaking UN office were particularly interested just before the opening of the last General Assembly session when the Secretary General asked for an additional item to be inscribed on the agenda. And this item is called Measures to Prevent Terrorism and Other Forms of Violence which endanger or take human lives or jeopardize fundamental freedoms. Well, several of us later, including Bronson, met the Secretary General to express satisfaction that he had asked the General Assembly to consider this question and to assure him of our interest and support. We also really wanted to find out whether he was thinking purely in terms of terrorism or whether he was thinking in terms of violence in a rather wider context. I believe the general feeling of those present at the meeting was that Dr. Valentine was genuinely disturbed at the increasing rate of violence and was prepared to risk any rebuff to his proceedings, which was certainly possible by inscribing the site on the agenda. In the event, The outcome of the debate was discouraging to anyone who was hoping for some positive action, that is, in relation to climate. A fourth case came in discussion of the title of the item as its climate appeared on the agenda, and the revised title was Measures to Prevent International Terrorism and so on, but also to study the underlying causes of those forms of terrorism and acts of violence which lie in misery, frustration, greed, and despair, and which cause some people to sacrifice human lives, including their own, in an attempt to effect radical changes. Well, the debate lasted for several weeks, and an attempt was made by several countries to reach agreement on one formula that would have expressed deep concern, and it has recorded that in certain means of force were illegitimate in all circumstances. But in the end, a different resolution prevailed, and this was submitted by the group of Arab African countries who have very particular views on this, and this resolution did no more than reserve its condemnation, not for the perpetrators of acts of terrorism, but for the continuation of repressive acts by colonial, racist, and alien regimes. And its nearest approach to action was to establish a committee to investigate the causes of acts of terrorism. There's a phrase in the report of the Secretary General on this subject which reads, even when the use of force is legally and morally justified, there are some means, as in every form of human conflict, which must not be used. The legitimacy of a cause does not in itself legitimize the use of certain forms of violence, especially against the innocent. And I quote that sentence because you might think that it is a sentiment that would find general acceptance. But in fact, at least two delegates during the debate explicitly rejected it, saying in effect that in certain circumstances, ends would justify any means, including the killing of innocent third parties. Now, at the UN level, the debate will continue at the next General Assembly, and probably at future ones. At most, I think it will concentrate on acts of international terrorism. But what about other forms of violence? It seems to me that this whole subject is one which must be of concern to friends. Do we have anything to say, anything to contribute in a situation where the tendency seems to be growing for people or groups to seek to achieve their objectives by violence rather than by argument or persuasion? What is our answer to the Fedayeen who might argue that the only alternative left to us, since all other efforts to recover our territory have failed, is to kill Israelis in raids across the border, or to freedom fighters in Mozambique, who see no other way of freeing themselves from an oppressive regime? We as friends, we're not involved directly, but what is our action from the point of view of our traditional attitude to violence when people take this life? It may be that we can do no more than engage ourselves and encourage others to engage themselves in studies and probings of the causes of violence with the hope that fresh guidance will emerge. And this very likely is where the AFSC seminars program can have a very useful part to play. But is this the most we can do, accepting the fact that any results from such an approach must be
Thank you. You will probably also continue to pursue
Well, our subject tonight is a challenge to power, Quaker action in the 70s. We have a treat in store for you tonight because we have a congressman with us, and we're going to have him talk with you a little bit about how things look from his perspective. This man may or may not be familiar to you, Congressman Charles Brown, and his legislative assistant, who will come now and for a few minutes discuss a few of these issues that we've been talking to Congressman and his constituents. Congressman Brown, welcome to this gathering. He's one of the two members that has a beard.
know, the Congress is somewhat upset about the impoundment of funds also. However, the only bill that I know of that's in process is in the Senate, and it's a complex legal problem, constitutional problem, which will probably have to be looked into by my legislative assistant before I'm prepared to make much of a statement on it. However, I'm sure that when the legislation which Mr. I think it's Senator Ervin has in process reaches the House, if it does, I will be prepared to act on it.
Well, we would really like it very much if you would propose similar legislation in the House. We are aware of his proposal, so 373, and would this be a possible move for you?
Well, I'm certainly not prepared to answer that question this time. However, we will look into it and see what we can do.
Please keep us informed.
We're very upset in our district about cuts in for daycare. Some of the mothers who have children at our center now are going to have to go on welfare. And these are urgent problems. It seems that things are going backwards instead of being solved.
What center is that?
The Buckley Memorial Community Daycare Center.
You can get that down. We'll look into that. I'll see what can be done. Is revenue sharing money not going to be available to help that out?
We don't think so, because with the new the HEW new guidelines, they're cutting the amount of money that a family can have make per year, and it's much lower than it was before. So I don't think revenue sharing is going to help this.
Well, we'll look into it. It's certainly not one of the things which Congress has been very happy about. But the cut in the impoundment has been across the board, you know, and by far the greatest immediate impoundment is in military affairs. If I understand the Quaker position, it's probably happy to have some of the impoundment of military funds.
On a percentage basis, the military funds can cut only by about 2%, while the agriculture funds can cut 20%, and the Environmental Protection Agency can cut almost 100%.
In fact, Mr. Congressman, as you probably know, the proposed military budget for next year has been increased by somewhat over $6 billion over the current year.
Well,
This is the place that we feel that without any added burden on the American taxpayer, that a drastic reduction is in order, and we really would like to know what you're going to do, not only in the general area of impoundment, but also in the area of getting the military budget cut down.
You know, the military budget has only just been produced, and we haven't really had a chance thoroughly to study it. However, I'd like you to remember that in our district, there is some reason to be a little bit wary about quick cuts in military spending. Certainly, we have at least two plants that I can think of where if they were released from, if the budget were cut too soon and too many people were unemployed on account, there'd be more people who wouldn't be able to go to the Buckley Daycare Center because they'd be on relief.
Congressman, we feel that this is a vicious circle. The impoundment is directly affecting a number of manpower training programs. I don't have the exact figures before me, but the programs were never adequate, and they are being reduced now. And those are the very programs that would enable retraining of the people in those plants for civilian work. We feel that the remedy for the problem is in your hands, and that it is not anything that we need to be concerned about, or that the people employed in the plants should be.
In fact, as little as 5 years ago, many of these plants were employed in civilian production, and that they have been taken over because of the better paying federal spending in the military area. Now they're producing anti-personnel weapons and a variety of other things, which I don't think is particularly useful for our, you know, particularly a good thing for our community. It might, for example, went into urban mass transportation. Many of these companies could be converted rather quickly into production of items useful for the the public as a whole.
Congressman, I would also like to point out that besides men who work in defense plants in our area, there are also children in our area, and milk
children
have been cut.
They may be voters someday.
Yes, they may. And I think you should keep your eye right on that.
I'm very concerned, Congressman Brown, about the whole role of the Congress. If the president can impound funds, what is going to happen to the traditional power of the first of Congress, and what is going to be the point of having Congress at all?
Well, the problem of impoundment is an old one. I believe that it began with Thomas Jefferson or somewhere about that time, and I expect that we may have the problem again. However, we aren't finished with the problem of impoundment, and I have some feeling for the vitality of Congress. There are a great many congressmen around here who have been congressmen for a long time and expect to be congressmen for an even longer time. And I'm one of them going to try to be.
Do you think then this will move you in the direction of supporting such bills as S-3R3 when they come to the House?
Certainly, after it's been thoroughly studied, and I have further time. By the time it gets to the House, it may be well amended. But we will certainly look into it, and I will certainly take into account the opinions which you've expressed here. Now, I'm sorry, but I believe I have a roll call, and I do have to leave you another appointment. And I thank you very much for having come, and we will look into the matter of the daycare center and into the problem that you brought up about the milk and babies, I believe what you were concerned about. And we'll see what can be done.
Mr. Congressman, we thank you very much. We appreciate your help with these local problems, but we do ask your continued support on the larger issue.
I thank you very much for coming all this way to see you.
Because he listened to you. There's some members of the House and Senate who run a one-man filibuster on their constituents. And I think maybe some of you have actually had that particular experience. In case you're one of those who had one of the members who wasn't quite as open and listening to your concerns as this particular congressman was, you may have considered at one time or another that the best thing you could do was to replace him by someone who might be a little more ready to listen to what you were having to say. Or you might even consider the possibility that you would sit in the seat behind the desk that he was sitting in. Now, if you should do that, and there are some friends in Congress, including one from this year meeting, who are in that position. There are others who have aspired to that job. And I think that it would be very helpful for us now to hear a little bit from one of the members of your year meeting who won the nomination of your party but lost the election this last November. Ask Katie Camp if she couldn't say just a word about some of the trials and tribulations of those who seek public office.
Thank you, Congressman. I think it's safe to say that our political democracy is not working very well. Well, I don't know if it's safe or not, but in fact, it's in serious trouble. And we've had plenty of testimony to that tonight. We are one house, one branch of the executive is dominated by another branch. The people are not being well served. Their best interests are not being taken into account. The cutoffs and cutbacks will affect millions of people. And the polls show that the people's priorities are not being followed. I think probably the best proof we have of the disaffection and the discouragement on the part of our population. 5%, which means that our chief executive was elected by 1/3 of the electorate. Hardly a landslide, or rather a great American sit-out. People feel manipulated, and people are manipulated, and I think that the politics of manipulation has to give way to a people movement, the people themselves asserting their rights and asserting power. So, don't get me wrong, I have no regrets about my own campaign. There were many positive aspects of it, aside from the personal, many more new friends made, new doors opened, new opportunities. I think we shattered some stereotypes, well, we cracked some stereotypical thinking about whether a 53-year-old happily married housewife can, well, maybe not win, but be a viable candidate, and similar new ideas. I think we may, in fact, prove to have improved the incumbent's record. We'll have to see about that. We have encouraged two women workers in our campaign to embark on their own beautiful campaign this season. And we did achieve a higher popular vote than the minority party has achieved hitherto, and I think perhaps that's a testimony to the good Quaker support we've received. We opened doors and we raised issues, and we must keep on raising issues. While being a candidate has made me an ardent advocate of campaign reform, let me just read you what Ralph Nader, who wrote that other Bible, says about who runs Congress. Congress is the great American default. The popular explanation for this is that it is under the domination of the White House and relentless special interests. There's no question that this is true. Why? Because in large part, Americans have failed to involve themselves in the activities of Congress, and they have failed to expend the energy to determine the direction these activities should take. Of the three branches of government, the executive and judicial, they get away with being insulated from the citizenry. But Congress is potentially the branch most exposed to democratic demand. So turning the Congress around for the people is the most practical and immediate priority in improving the executive and judicial branches as well. The stakes are now so apparent and so mountainous that accomplishing this transformation by the people must be viewed as an obligation, not just a right of citizenship. This citizenship must be ingrained as part of the daily work of the American. Well, the incumbent has a tremendous overwhelming advantage. And in fact, up until the last election in the Congress, the turnover was only 7% at each election for the House of Representatives, and that mostly by death and old age. The greatest advantage, of course, is in the area of exposure and public funding. And I have just sent a report to the Communications Subcommittee of the Senate Commerce Committee, which is holding hearings on campaign reform, and I'm suggesting that candidates must have equal opportunity. And this means, I think, public funding. This also would cut down on the enormous expenses which run into the millions of dollars for Senate. And in my own campaign, I was denied an opportunity to receive front funds from a very good liberal organization which liked my program because I was not spending $100,000. I was spending considerably less than that. So I couldn't qualify. They wouldn't even consider that I had a chance. And that's the way it is. Also in my district, one party spent 19 times the amount the other party, the losing party, spent on this election. Another thing that we must have, I think, is equality of opportunity in the area of access to the media. And again, great deal because the other side didn't want to. So that must be mandated. It can be limited, small amounts, but equal amounts, which is very helpful. And then the candidate doesn't have to spend most of his or her time raising funds and planning how to make news that will make the front page to attract attention. And many of them. Party rigidity, I hope, is being made more flexible. I don't know just what the answer is to this, although candidates for school board are now in the state being able to cross-file, perhaps that's certainly in the right direction. Maybe having four parties is a good idea, but in Canada, it's very hard to get to the other parties. You have to break down that rigidity somehow. And the other crucial immediate thing that we can do is to make registration automatic for everyone, instead of making it so difficult to register at just the right time and just the right place that this is just becomes just another means of preserving the status quo. So all of this is important to sustain and develop this people movement, which is what must take over the call. And Quakers are people too. We must help each other. We must, as the FCNL is helping us, and the FCNL and the AFSC and the FPC and the DTC, make it very easy for any of us to be candidates. They make us all potential candidates because they supply our platform. And we must all help each other in a similar way. I think the FCNL, however, has a very difficult job to try to make a responsible body out of this Congress. It reminds me of trying to build a house out of cotton candy. It's full of air and it's overly rich. It's sticky. But we Quakers must help them strengthen their building material, which is the personnel. It has been suggested in this community house that one way friends might do this is by all of us moving to Delaware. We could thereby concentrate our power and be sure to elect some representatives. Well, while that may not be quite practical, I think the principle is a good one, and there are other ways in which we can concentrate our power. We can try to search out candidates. Candidates, we can run candidates, we can back them, and try to do so together in blocks within our political districts, whatever they are, to as large as we can become. Again, we mustn't let party differences, I don't want to gloss over the fact that there are party differences between us, but I think all of us are human beings first, and Quakers secondly. And perhaps our party comes down around 7 or 8 somewhere around where the dentists or cello players or Phillies fans or something like that. And that we have higher loyalties than our political party, I hope. I think then that if we are really believe in the sacredness of love, we do care for one another, and we must deal with that power which involves itself in all aspects of our lives, the political power. This means that sacrifices are called for, and among them is that working politically through our Quaker organizations, individually, and even in cause of itself.
Thank you, Kay. I haven't heard that suggestion about all the friends moving to Delaware, but it strikes me as a fairly good idea, because if you could elect a congressman, you ought to be able to elect two senators, since the congressmen run the statewide there. Your mention of the campaign financing also brings to mind the fact that the early returns that are coming in show that only 4% of the people are taking advantage of that provision to check off to finance the national campaign, which is a disgrace. Here was a way by which at least it was thought that there might be a fund built up which would lead to the public financing of the campaign. immediate Internal Revenue Service apparently has not been too interested in forwarding that idea. That form is far back of the paper that you received. There's no place on the form itself to specifically do it in an easy checkoff way. In fact, the special form is not included apparently in many of the returns which are distributed through banks and other public places. So it's not easy to take to participate even in this first small step towards the public financing campaign, which I think is just crucial if we're ever going to have some new, basically new policies in this country. It seems to me that the Friends of the Physician is on public affairs in many ways is quite revolutionary, quite profoundly revolutionary. Terms of our attitudes toward violence and of respect for the individual and the feeling that the nation state is not the first order of the universe. Now, if one takes these points of view, then I think we have to be aware that what we're having to do is to have profound changes in public attitudes and public institutions to accomplish these goals. We can't begin just at the lobbying stage. The FCNL is working at that lobbying stage. But legislative work is kind of the end of the process. The whole change of public attitudes, which occur through education primarily, in the homes, in the first day schools, meetings for worship, regular schools that the children go to, mass media, and our community attitudes and how they're created. When we get to the point that we have enough people who out of all of those experiences are looking at the world in a little different way, a profoundly different way, a lot of these jobs that we're working on are going to be a good bit easier than they are now. I can say, and I think probably Raymond Wilson would say even more so, that it is not a completely losing battle, although we're in a situation where it seems to be a time of great discouragement. But there are more members of Congress now who accept the validity of this kind of approach than there were 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 15 years ago, or 20, or 30 years ago. I think there's progress, but it seems at times to be painfully, painfully slow, and so many retrogressions. That seems to be the kind of period that we're in now. We have these kinds of ideas, then the job is to transmit them, the values they represent, to the people who are making the decisions. And that's what we were trying to talk about a little bit here at the beginning of this session, how we go about this process. Bring to the policymakers, or become a policymaker yourself, so that we can actually implement these things and maybe vote in the minority for a long time, but hopefully vote in an increasing minority until it becomes a majority. I think we have to take a very long view of these matters, and we have to keep working every day. Now, the FCNL is just the part of it that works on legislation and lobbying. There's direct action, there's political action, many other ways by which people transmit these values. We have our staff now, nearly 20. We have two friends in Washington. One, Sam Levering, is doing some very important work on the seabed issue, stimulated primarily by several members of this year meeting. We saw this coming down the road and moved to have friends to take a lead. Richard Post has been working on the question of better relations between the United States and Cuba. All of a sudden, same things seem to be opening up there. 12 House Republicans and Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia calling for a rapprochement with Cuba, most surprising turn of events. He's working on that. This is our 30th anniversary year. We're looking forward to celebrating this occasion with many friends around the country. The Swarthmore Peace Committee got a special effort to try to raise funds for us, and I want to just encourage you to take a look at the green sheet that they have on the literature table up above in the exhibit room, because if you subscribe to magazines, there's no reason why that extra amount of money that goes to the magazine or the dealer shouldn't help you support the work of that you have and the Sport and Peace Committee to tell you how to do that. Now, we talked a bit here, and Christian Delbert laid out very well the kind of problems that we're confronting down in Washington. And friends, this is really a very, very serious situation. Let me just outline very briefly what we see as the way that we're approaching this in terms of steps. So that if you get action bulletins or calls for action or see something happen, you'll understand at least where it fits in the total context. First of all, there are a number of pieces of legislation that expire this year in the fields of education and manpower training and health and so on. Those bills, those laws should be extended by new authorizations. That's step number one. We have to authorize continuing programs. Second is a matter of appropriating money for programs. And what we are hoping is that the military budget will be cut and the domestic programs will be increased. This kind of action is going to be very difficult. It's going to have to take place on many different appropriations bills. There are already some on the vocational training, others are coming up right now. The assumption is that those bills have to be passed by a two-thirds majority in both houses every time in order to survive a presidential veto. That is a kind of a benchmark that we haven't had to confront for quite a while. And that is why so many organizations are joining forces, these coalitions that Christian mentioned, to work together so that environmental groups aren't just working on theirs, and then they don't care about the agriculture groups or the health groups or the education groups or whatever it would be. What we're finding is that almost nobody knows much about the military budget or why it should be cut and where it should be cut. So this is something that seems to be falling a great deal on the FCNL to try to expound to our colleagues in other organizations. So that is the second to the appropriation process. The third, these are for next year, for the fiscal year beginning July 1st. And the third step is impoundment. The issue of impoundment that these men were talking to their congressmen about. Because if the Congress can even survive the president's two-thirds of his veto and pass over his veto, the president can still out the money, not spend it, then what's to be done? So these empowerment bills are brought in to assure that if the president feels that the money should not be spent, even after it's appropriated, the Congress can ultimately reverse that decision in some organized way, in procedure. The Irvin bill that they were talking about is the one in the Senate. And that is the one that seems to us to be most desirable. Because it says that if the president is going to impound the money, then he tells Congress about it. But it can't be impounded unless Congress approves his impoundment. The bill in the House that they're trying to build support for is the Mahon bill. It says the president's impoundment will take place unless Congress affirmatively votes that it shouldn't. Now, that burden of proof is very, very important. We feel that the Irvin bill is our Mahon bill. And this fight is going to come into the papers and under the House and Senate floor very soon. The fourth issue is tax reform. Tax reform. We have to, where everyone seems to be accepting the idea that there's going to be some kind of a limit, a ceiling. There has to be a responsible ceiling on fiscal spending. And therefore, if you want to restore the money to the domestic programs, it has to come from someplace else. Come from cuts in the military program and can come from tax reform, which plugs certain loopholes. Christian Delbert testified for the AFSC and the FCNL a couple of weeks ago before the House Ways and Means Committee, setting forth
facts and recommendations for tax